The last considerations that we wanted to propose about the ARM family of processors concern the supervisor mode. It is possible that we want to provide protective barriers between programs. For example, we need to make access to some shared resources, and we want to avoid conflicts between the programs that many users can write and that need to use those resources, for example, shared memory areas. In this case, the ARM architecture, but this is a property that often is provided by microprocessor, allows to call suitable functions, suitable tasks, like let's say, of the operating system, asking to it, let's say, to perform some operations for us, for the user program, on those resources that are so delicate that we don't have permissions to access to them. The supervisor mode in the ARM family allows exactly this possibility. We use the SWI instruction that allows to enter in such a kind of mode that is followed often by a label that corresponds to information that can be, let's say, passed to the supervisor mode to perform the requested task. The supervisor mode, called through a software interrupt, sets the program counter to a fixed memory access, that is 8, and is characterized by the conditional field that makes it to be executed under a certain condition. The operating code, an argument with 24 bits, is often passed to the supervisor mode code to request special services. As an alternative, the registers R0, R1, R2, R3 are used. The current program status register will be saved in the saved program status register in the mode that we are considering, and when returning from this mode, the content of the link register R14 of the specific mode S+C will be copied in the program counter, and the same for the saved program status register in the current program status register. In the slide number 104, we have the presentation of a general code for the management of the supervisor call. We have three examples at the beginning of the slide, at the top of the slide, that present three calls, SWI. The first one reads the next character from the input stream. The second one writes a suitable character, for example, a K, to the output stream. And the third one is a call that is executed under a condition, not equal condition, with zero in the comment field. After entering in the supervisor mode, the program counter is set at the fixed address 0008. And we see in the slide that in that address we have an instruction that branches to a label called supervisor. This label is the address of the routine that will manage the choice, the switching between the three options that we have assumed. And therefore, our question could be how to organize such a kind of management of the possible calls, the possible actions that must be made depending on the particular software call that must be executed. Typically, the mechanism is based on a table That is very similar to the concept of vectorized interrupts, or to the concept of the switch table that we have introduced a few lessons ago. As you can see from the code, you see an address that is called entry table, and corresponding to this address, we have three declarations of suitable labels that corresponds to the addresses of the routine that the supervisor will execute correspondingly to the calls that have been presented at the top of the slide. The name of those labels remembers the action that must be performed. Then we have three assignments of constant values to the labels 0, read C, and write I. And then we have the code that is the most interesting thing that we have to understand. The first thing that we use is the stack area, and therefore the store multiple instruction in a stack that, just to consider an example, is a full descending stack addressed by the stack pointer R13, into which those registers that will be used in such a kind of code are saved, so R0, R1, R2, and of course the link register. Then we have a load that is R0, R14, minus 4. In other words, we take the link register, in particular the address contained into it, we decrement it by 4, and we consider the memory location pointed by R14 minus 4 that will correspond to the SWI instruction. Consider, in fact, that the SWI instruction caused the jump to this part of the code, but before jumping, the program counter has been surely saved and incremented just to address the next instruction that must be executed after the servicing of this kind of call. Therefore, R14 minus 4 is the software, the supervisor mode call itself. And this instruction is loaded in R0. That is, physically, the object code of the instruction is in R0. The next operation consists into a bit clear instruction that clears, that sets to 0, the highest 8 bits, the mask 0xFF00000 sets to 0 those bits that in the mask are set to 1. So you see the FF means the highest 8 ones. The other ones are left as they are. You will surely remember that the 8 highest bits correspond in the format of the instruction to the conditional field and to the operating code. So what we have at the end of this operation is the 24 bits that represent the argument of the SWI instruction. This argument is shifted 8 positions right by the successive instruction move R1, R0, LSR8, and this quantity is transferred in the register R1. Then R2 is loaded with the value of the entry table address, that is the starting address of the table with the memory locations containing the addresses of the routines that must be executed. And the last instruction loads in R15, that is the program counter, what? The memory location addressed by R2, the entry table, plus R1, that is the argument shifted 8 positions left, and left shift logical 2, that is multiplied by 4. Remember, in fact, that the addresses in the ARM processor are 32-bit wide. So, if we consider an argument, clearly this argument must multiplied by 4. This argument represents, let's say, an index, and to switch in the table among the several possibilities that we have corresponding to every operation that must be done, clearly we must multiply such an index by 4. The memory that is addressed by this number, this, is read, and the content of that location, that is the address of the routine, must be executed, is loaded in the program counter. This is equivalent to jump at that address, and therefore to execute, for example, the suitable routine that we need to elaborate, like for example the write IRTN that we know is one of the calls that we have declared at the beginning that send a key to the output stream of the processor, and the key, that is the argument that we want to send in output, will correspond to the 07 bits of the register R0. At the end of this routine, a suitable and we could say dual instruction, load multiple full descending stack pointed by R13 and restoring R0, R1, R2 and the program counter with the content of the stored link register will be executed, and this allow us to exit from the supervisor mode. Remember that the qualifier at the end of the instruction activates the S bit in the instruction decoded, and therefore forces the copy of the saved program status register in the current program status register. Till now, we have supposed, as in the previous example, that the routines to handle each supervisor call are written in ARM assembly. But what happens if they are written in C? The top level handler will use a branch and a link instruction to jump the appropriate C function that will be located at a suitable address. For example, in the slide 105, this label is called CSWI handler. Therefore, we need to invoke the C routine that will handle every particular service that must be managed under SWI. But how to pass the SWI number, which is now stored in R0, to the C function? That is, how to pass the argument to the C function. Typically, registers R0, R1, R2 and R3 are used to pass the parameters into the routine, and they correspond to the first up to the fourth argument in the C routine. Of course, we have to pass other parameters, if they are, using the stack. A function executed by the ARM processor and written in C just to serve a specific request under the SWI call will return a one word integer value in the register R0, a two to four word integer values in R0, R1, R0, R2, or R0, R1, R2, R3. That is, the registers from R0 to R3 are used both to pass four parameters in input to the C function and to pass the parameters, better, the results from the routine to the calling program. In slide 107, for example, we have a skeleton of a suitable handler written in C that switches among the several values that the number we are passing to it, the argument of the supervisor call, can assume. However, looking better to the usage of the stack area, we can say that the top level SWI handler can pass if many parameters are necessary, not all the parameters to the stack, but the stack pointer value to the C routine. For example, using the second register R1, the stack pointer will point the supervisor stack, so we can execute move R1SP and then branch and link CSWI handler with the implicit idea that we have loaded in the supervisor handler stack area all the parameters that we need to use in that routine. Some final concerns, some final issues can be expressed at the end of this session. The first is about how the fast interrupt management is faster than the normal IRQ. Consider that the FIQ vector is the last entry in the vector table. This allows to put the handler directed into the vector location and not to force a jump from that location to another part of the memory where the routine is present. This clearly eliminates the need for this branch and the associated delay. Moreover, if the system has a cache, the vector table and the FIQ handler will are, let's say, contained in one block of this cache, and the execution of such a kind of a fast interrupt service will clearly be accelerated. Moreover, the FIQ interrupt management features more banked registers than IRQ, and even this aspect contributes to accelerate the execution. Therefore, it is necessary less time to store or to save and to restore the registers. ARM manages through the SWI mechanism those situations into which traps occur. And this is a little bit different from exceptions that instead are managed through interrupts. What is the difference between exceptions and traps? Exceptions typically are situations that are synchronous with instructions, but typically are unpredictable. For example, a division by zero. A division between two variables into which we cannot say if the divisor is zero or not. Therefore, if this happens, it was not possible to foresee this a priori. The management of such a kind of situation is built on top of the interrupt mechanism, and therefore exceptions are typically vectorized and characterized by priorities. As we said, traps instead are representing software interrupts, and they are, let's say, deviations from the normal serial execution of the instructions due to some situations that, however, can be foreseen. For example, the execution of an undefined instruction better, the tentative to execute an undefined instruction. Or, for example, the situation into which we try to make access to a forbidden memory area. All these situations can be managed through a call to the supervisor mode, passing to it a suitable code so as to distinguish the service of the different situations. Therefore, ARM uses the SWI instruction to manage traps. And finally, some releases of the ARM7 processor feature the presence of a coprocessor, that is, another function unit that is involved in the execution of a code through the call of a suitable instruction. For example, often the typical ARM7 processors work only on integer variables, and floating point units are often structured and added to the main one as coprocessors. ARM allows up to 16 designer selected coprocessors. Floating point coprocessor working on variables with 80 bits uses the units 1 of the previously mentioned 16 and 2, but appears as 1. The instructions that characterize it are the CDP, coprocessor data processing, LDC, load coprocessor, MCR, move to coprocessor variable from an ARM register, MRC, the vice versa, STC, the store coprocessor. With this, we end the section of the course that is devoted to the embedded processor philosophy. We described some general issues in the first part, and then we focused our attention to the characteristics of a very popular and diffused device as the ARM7 One. Now, we have still 1 month before the lessons end, and we surely leave space to exams, to tests, and to understand how to solve them. I probably think that the 2 weeks on June could be devoted to such an aspect of the preparation. But in the remaining weeks that we have in this month of May, I would like to propose you a section that in the last year wasn't presented typically to the students, and that is devoted to the analog interfacing. Many of the topics that are presented in such a kind of chapter recovers concepts that you have seen in the courses electronics and mechatronics in the first part of your studies, but we will learn and see them from the point of view of an engineer that sooner or later must control those devices by programming suitably a microprocessor. So we will see how to interface the micro with a sample and hold unit with a multiplexer, but in particular we will see the interfacing with analog to digital converter and all those errors that the introduction of such a kind of important unit that transforms an analog value corresponding to a physical magnitude acquired by a transducer into a binary number that can be read by a microprocessor, elaborated, and eventually used to control the overall process. Okay, let's make reference to this new section and to the group of the slides that you find on the website under the title Analog Interfacing. We make reference to the circuit shown in the slide number 2, a classic example of an acquisition chain featuring the presence of one or more sensors together with their filtering unit. All the sensors are grouped into a multiplexer input, and the different inputs of the multiplexer are selected with the suitable commands sent by the acquisition unit to the conversion amplification stage. One output of the multiplexer corresponds to the selected input value. Eventually it is amplified, eventually it is sampled, but surely it is converted into a binary number and then acquired by the acquisition unit. The acquisition unit is what we have always called controller of the system, and clearly is a role played by a microprocessor. In this kind of figure, the interfacing between the acquisition unit and the remaining parts of the circuit is performed through the presence of a decoupling stage, an opto-insulator. It is, a device that exploits the transfer of information through the presence of a LED diode and a photomultiplier or a phototransistor, so no physical contact between the source of the information and the receiving unit relative to that information is present, and this helps to keep the voltages and the grounds separated between acquisition and the remaining electronics of such a kind of chain. Several commands are sent by the acquisition unit, so we can say that even this part is related to many issues, many electronic issues. The role of the informatics in this section of the course is in any case mandatory, and it is what we want to describe. We see the control signals sent to the multiplexer for selecting the inputs. We see the signals control signals sent to the amplification unit to select a possible gain between those that characterize the amplification. We see the sample command and the start and the end of conversion that interface the analog to digital converter with the acquisition unit. Apart from this, what are the functions that typically are performed by the acquisition unit? The first is, behind the control signals that we have just mentioned. Every device needs to be activated
So it is necessary to establish the activation times and takes and to take under control the synchronization between the devices, that is the correct sequence of the activation and the need for times that are compliant. I mean that we cannot expect 1 hour after selecting the multiplexer input and the right amplification for performing the sampling and for sending the start of conversion to the ADC. Often, during the life of the components, the answer is not always constant, but time after time, it undergoes to drift, that is, following a specific rule, it could change. That is, what is the response of a device, for example, a sensor, at the beginning of the year, will not the same value after 10 months, for example. This requires that the acquisition unit performs a continuous monitoring and a anti-drift calibration, that is, periodically establishes a set of tests, you could say a campaign, providing suitable values to each one of these devices that characterize the acquisition chain, reading the output value and determining a new curve, a new transfer function that reflects in a more affordable way the new conditions into which that component is working. Of course, we expect that all the electronic variables and all the electronic signals can be affected by certain degrees of noise, disturbances, and perturbing magnitudes effects. It is one of the tasks of the acquisition unit to estimate these effects and, let's say, the amount of their influence on the overall value that is acquired. Not rarely, the values that are acquired by the sensors, such a chain of this type, are used to derive other calculations, other physical magnitudes. The typical example is on the competitive cars in Formula One, where we can find from 300 to 400 sensors spread on board, but the variables that are calculated from those acquisitions can reach 800, 900 possible different values. Clearly, each of these calculations, each of these values must be considered and evaluated, and finally the acquisition unit is responsible to understand if those values are acceptable or if a diagnostic procedure should be activated to understand what happened in the chain, so as that value is no more reliable, who is the responsible, and how to overcome such a kind of problem. We, let's say, cross now the acquisition chain with a few comments related to every component that we meet in this way. Clearly, there are components that require more comments. Other components instead will be, described very briefly, very essentially. Like, for example, the block responsible for filtering. We well know that such a kind of operation is related to the elimination of the aliasing effect. That is a consequence of the sample procedure. We know that if we sample a signal whose frequency is fs with a sampling frequency fc, the new signal that we will have a bandwidth that is from fc minus fs up to fc plus fs. But this is not the only component that will characterize that signal, because other components in frequency, other harmonics will be present, centered around 2fc, 3fc, 4fc and more. Every component will have the same bandwidth, that is 2fs at least, but for example, the component at 2fc will have a bandwidth ranging from 2fc minus fs up to 2fc plus fs. And the component, the harmonic, centered onto 3fc will have a bandwidth from 3fc minus fs up to 3fc plus fs, and more and more and more. So all these components must be eliminated from the final, signal that will be acquired by the microprocessor, and the filtering is the operation necessary to do this, because it will give back a signal with only the specific bandwidth into which we are interested. Of course, filtering is also necessary for eliminating the noise and all zero mean components, and in this case filtering will be not carried out through an electronic circuit, but it could be carried out also by the acquisition unit. The characteristics that identify a good filtering block are the input impedance, the output impedance, clearly the cutoff frequency, and the transfer function. All of them are typically available in the datasheet. As we said, the multiplexer is a device that selects between several inputs the one that must be sent to the conversion unit. We have, generally speaking, n signals coming from n sensors, but the stage of the conversion is available for only one, and this is typically a choice that is made both for reducing, for keeping limited the costs of the electronic circuits and in general of the acquisition procedure, but also to keep limited the number of the control signals that must be managed by the microprocessor point of view. Clearly, this brings a price to be paid. That is, we can't have simultaneous samples, but we have to select the channels of the multiplexer and provide each one of them to the analog to digital converter. This limits the sampling frequency that we can have, but in any case the typical capability of elaboration and of the conversion of the successive components is in general so fast that will allow us to maintain enough high sampling frequencies for the typical signals into which we are interested. In the slide number 3, possible architecture for a multiplexer is presented. You see, just to consider an example, two channels, but let's say the core of the unit is represented by those capacitors and by those switches that allow to take a signal from the left part, let's say, of the circuit, the channel connected to the suitable transducer, and after the switch to provide it to the following components, that is the amplification, the conversion, and finally the acquisition unit. The switching units are typically carried out through MOS transistors, and the figure clearly shows that at every time only one channel is in the so-called hold phase, that is the corresponding capacitor has been charged and its value is proposed to the amplification input, while all the other channels are in the sample phase, that is their relative capacitors are in charge or are charged with the values that arrive from the specific transducers connected to those channels. This is called the fly capacitor multiplexer. It features, let's say, commutation times in the order of the milliseconds. This is an important issue because it affects the overall time necessary for managing the acquisition chain. We will have a time also for settling the amplification unit, for converting, so we can say the time that the acquisition unit must respect to select from the present channel the new one is the sum of the time necessary for every component to work. And typically this is not critical, but is an issue that must be considered and of course limits the sampling frequency. Milliseconds because that circuit that is shown in the figure number 3 is an RC circuit. The C, that is the capacitor, is evident from the picture. The R, the resistance component, is the value of the resistor represented by the MOS circuit when it is interdicted, when it, let's say, doesn't work, it is switched off. We can assume a value of virtual resistance close to 1 mega ohm, for example, and we can assume that a typical capacitor is 1 nanofarad of size, therefore 10 power 6 times 10 power minus 9 gives 10 power minus 3 the milliseconds that is mentioned in the slide. What is the life of these components? Quite high, but limited, 1 million commutations, due to the fact that the commutations of the switches are not infinite, especially if the switches are carried out not with transistors or MOS circuits, but with relay. In this case, the life of the components is clearly shorter than in case of using semiconductor devices. The solution allows to, let's say, implement a galvanic insulation because physically separates the part related to the transducing operativity of the chain from the part that is connected to the amplification and the conversion. And as we know, this is important. We could say that in this way we could avoid the opto insulation that we have seen in the previous slide. Clearly we need a high input impedance to avoid the capacitor discharge during the conversion, I mean a high impedance of the operational amplifier, because it is not evident by the picture, but the input impedance of the operational amplifier is a resistance, and if this resistance is not high, the capacitor will lose charge and will provide, let's say, a current that will cross this resistance. If this resistance is high, theoretically infinite, this phenomenon doesn't happen, and the value that is stored in the capacitor, that is the magnitude we want to read with the acquisition unit, will be kept for an interval of time enough long. An alternative solution for multiplexing is represented by a semiconductor device shown in the slide number 4. Clearly the size of such a component is very small compared to the previous one. We don't have a galvanic insulation because the commutation that allows to select the input channels and to propose one of them in output is made through logic gates. You see the architecture of these gates in the figure. And this allows immediately to have a longer, let's say, life. We can reach 10 power 9 commutations and shorter commutation times because the components involved are not capacitors. So we don't have to wait the time for the charging of this electronic component, but we have basically semiconductor gates, that is transistors only in this kind of circuit. The commutation time can reach microseconds, so in this case the component that we have introduced in the acquisition chain doesn't affect at all the overall time the acquisition unit must wait for switching from one channel to the next one. In that case, let's say the most responsible for determining the amount of this time will be the analog to digital converter. The typical characteristics that identify a multiplexer are the number of the channel, the commutation speed, depending on the solution that we have preferred, the open-close circuit resistances. In particular, this is important if we have selected the fly capacitor solution. Otherwise, in case we consider the semiconductor version, these values are negligible in the terms that they don't are a critical issue in the component. And consider that the commands that arrive from the microprocessor correspond especially for the fly capacitor multiplexer to real sample and old commands. Clearly, these commands must have enough duration to allow the sampling, also considering that we have to wait time for the settling of the signal in the amplifier, and we have to wait a time relative to the conversion of the ADC. So we can sample at a certain velocity, but we need to hold the signal enough stable to respect the characteristics of the following components in the chain. This is an issue, I repeat, in particular for the fly capacitor. Instead, for the multiplexer based on semiconductor devices, this is not an issue in the sense that a sample and old explicit unit and a separate unit will be present in the chain, while in the case of the fly capacitor unit we can say that the sample and old is embedded into the multiplexer stage itself.